The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's now time for Just the Terror with Nick Guerra. It was my own voice. I'm 23 and in college. I live in a small college town in a two-bedroom apartment by myself. About 2 weeks ago, I was taking out the trash. The dumpster at my complex isn't too far from my place. I have a camera on my door, so I typically don't lock the door. Also, I was carrying heavy furniture, so I wouldn't have been able to lock the door anyway. When I returned from the trash, I heard complaining on the other side of my front door. I say complaining because the voice sounded loud and upset. The voice sounded familiar. The voice was my voice. When I realized this, I froze in fear for about 10 seconds. Then I tried to open my door. The door was locked. Well, as soon as I put my hand on the door, the voice stopped. I've thought about what this could have been over and over again. I checked my camera. It typically picks up movement in the moment, and it usually picks up sound. Nothing was there. My friend said that maybe it could have been some kind of glitch in the matrix or like a residual haunting. My own angry energy sticking around, but I'm not sure. I'm just hoping it wasn't a mimic or something worse. The Nowhere Door, written by Christian Wallace. Dr. Daniel Vance was a smart man. Too smart for his own good, maybe. 40 years old, a lecturer in fluid dynamics, with a mind made of shapes and numbers. No one knows why, but one day on a whim, he crunched the numbers on the apocalypse and came to a troubling conclusion. He didn't share exactly what it was he deduced, but given that he immediately quit his job and liquidated his many assets, it's fair to say it wasn't positive. Swept up in the wake of this tremendous upheaval was his wife, a 24-year-old PhD student who had grown infatuated with Daniel sometime before. She loved this strange bear of a man who could just as easily build a log cabin as he could explain the idiosyncrasies of an asteroid's orbit. Speaking to Daniel always left you with the profound impression that he was right. So when he told her what he wanted to do, she agreed. 15 years and 5 children later, the Vances were living in the distant woods just beyond my hometown. They were enigmatic, richer than the Pope, and extremely serious about their prepper lifestyle. But they were also funny, easygoing, incredibly compelling to speak to. Larger-than-life survivalists who swept into town with bizarre requests that thrilled local businesses. Vast quantities of cement, iron, lead, and steel, all shipped through the remote mountains so that the Vances could build their shelter. The advanced methods they used to keep it secret were legendary. Daniel had once spent 6 months earning the necessary license to drive HGVs up to his compound, just so that no one else would lay eyes on it. On one occasion, when a company had refused his request for GPS tracker-free vehicles, he bought them out wholesale, so that they had no choice. It was during the pandemic that the Vances stopped appearing in town. Requests for food and goods also stopped, and all contact was dropped. Most of us attributed this sudden absence to the lockdown. They had a bunker, spent their entire lives training to be self-sufficient in the face of civilization's collapse. Even Alexander, the youngest at just 3, was already collecting firewood as a chore and learning what local plants were edible. Most of us just assume that if anyone could ride out COVID without breaking a sweat, it would be the Vances. It would be discovered that Daniel had used the pandemic as an excuse for a dry run. The family intended to spend 6 months in lockdown to essentially beta test their fallout bunker. 3 months in, the sheriff received a distressed call on the radio. Coordinates were provided by the hushed voice of a sobbing child. It was assumed to be Alexander, even though that's never been proven. When the police arrived, they found the bunker still sealed. It took hours for emergency responders to cut into the door. All the while, efforts were made to contact the family within, but to no avail. Once inside, police were left dumbfounded. There was no one to be rescued. No bodies, no survivors. There was evidence the door's locking mechanism had failed, trapping the Vances inside with no way out. But if so, where had they gone? Beds and cots lay everywhere with moldering yellow sheets, buckets with stains all around them. Some doors were barred, others smashed to pieces. There was even evidence of makeshift quarantines, and in places, evidence of what looked like violence. The police, usually a fantastic source of gossip, were not forthcoming until the town demanded answers. The sheriff was forced to offer only the barest of outlines. An outbreak of waterborne illness had struck the Vances not long after they were locked inside and unable to seek help. Rumors of contagion were overstated, fueled by the unrelated rise of COVID. Whatever contaminant had killed the Vances, it was non-organic in nature. No need to panic. The Vances' loved ones have been notified. The bunker is going to be demolished, and we could all put this terrible tragedy behind us. Of course, we still had questions, thousands of them. Why hadn't the family called for help? They had radios, computers, even smartphones. They were survivalists, not Amish. And where were they? What happened to their bodies? Why hadn't they simply left? Although we shouted these questions and more at the town meeting, the police simply refused to comment. For most of us, the excitement lasted another week or two. Then we realized we weren't going to get answers. Besides, the pandemic was in full swing. Most of us had other things to worry about. The tragic mystery of the Vance family eventually faded, becoming just one of those awful things in the town's history that we didn't talk about. I was as guilty as anyone of just forgetting about it. I certainly never expected to find the bunker out there in the woods. Faded police tape still on the open door that hung wide open with scorch marks around the locks. It stood out in the woods like someone had cut a hole right in the fabric of reality. The darkness, so deep and black, it almost ached to look at it. The sight of it made my heart drop into my stomach. It radiated pain. Does that make sense? I think some part of my lizard brain picked out details that wouldn't become apparent to me until I got closer. Bloody finger streaks that stained the handle from where someone had scrabbled furiously at the lock without success. The tiny viewing window smashed with a hammer that still lay nearby. I needed only to glimpse it to imagine the family taking turns standing there, screaming into the woods, desperate for rescue. Under any other circumstance, I would have run. But I'd gone there looking for my dog, Ripley. My light revealed a few wet paw prints making their way down the dusty concrete tunnel. Half Bernese and half Collie, Ripley's the sort of dog who trembles in my arms when a store rattles the windows. The sort of dog who needs his paws held when we brush him. I love him. I don't have much of a family or a wife or even many friends, but I have Ripley. I could no more have turned around and gone home to an empty apartment where I would have to sob my grief away than I could flap my arms and fly. He was my dog. I had raised him since he was a puppy. I wasn't going to leave him out in those woods. I went in after him. I didn't know what to expect, but I knew it wouldn't be good. Whatever the police had found, they not only kept most of the morbid details to themselves, they'd also lied. The bunker was not demolished or even sealed off. In fact, looking at the occasional blue latex glove tossed aside, the one or two broken police issue flashlights, it seemed like the last people inside had been in a hurry to get out. Given this was where seven people had presumably died, I assumed it was someone's job to clean it all up. But the corridor looked largely untouched. Just a few meters in, manic writing covered the walls. The desperate scrawls of a lone survivor left there to be rediscovered like cave paintings. Most were deliberations of how to get out. Diagrams, blueprints, equations, and formula. All focused on the door and the circuits responsible for its faulty lock. On one wall, I noticed a simple diagram of the bunker made in chalk. It had three floors. The top floor was labeled quarters. The middle floor was labeled workshops. The bottom, storage. I noticed there was a large red X drawn through the bottom. I instinctively assumed these drawings belonged to Daniel. Slowly, the writing changed from equations and plans to a desperate scrawl. The same few phrases repeated over and over. Five doors. Five. Not six. Six. Didn't make it. Didn't make it. Six doors. Six. It seemed like the kind of thing you'd find in an asylum. Right at the end of the scrawlings, a psychotic rambling punctuated only by six paragraphs. Each small paragraph was topped with a beautifully drawn Christian cross. Every letter was impeccably neat. Elliot Vance, age 15, a gifted guitarist. He liked boys even though he thought I did not know. I loved him with everything I had. He would have made a great man. Alicia Vance, age 14, she liked to paint and to shoot. She had her mother's mean streak. It would have served her well in the future. Elijah Vance, aged 8, the smartest of us all. These were Daniel's memorials to his family. It became apparent that he'd been the last to die. What a god-awful fate for a man to outlive his children. Seeing the words lit up by my flashlight was a haunting insight into the overwhelming despair he'd endure. He must have realized he wouldn't get the chance to speak at his family's funerals or to write their obituaries. This was his last desperate way of making sure the world might one day know them as he did, as real people. The words marked the end of the tunnel, standing adjacent to a trapdoor into the ground. It was not open, but the tunnel came to a dead end immediately. Ripley's prince disappeared at the hatch. I feared he might be in danger. But still I stopped and looked at the bunker door, now 20 meters behind me. The once gloomy forest looked so bright, even on this cloudy day, the air dotted with rain. A part of me felt like I was leaving the whole world behind as I began to climb down the ladder. I entered a large circular living space, packed with furniture, little nooks and crannies. Walls were covered with folding beds and tables. Every inch was multifunctional. A dining space could become a sitting space, which in turn might be where someone slept or even exercised. It all depended on what particular bit of furniture you unfolded or unclipped or unfurled. Seven people in close quarters? Nowhere near enough privacy. It made sense they went with this cluttered, overlapping use of space. But it was still a large room, bigger than most studio apartments. There were even a few corridors that led deeper into the earth, telling me the bunker had unseen depths. I looked for some sign of my dog and soon found his trail. But this far from the rainy forest, Ripley's prints were starting to fade. After barely a few meters, they petered out vaguely in the direction of a nearby door. I wanted to follow, but stopped myself from rushing onwards. It was unlikely Ripley was getting out any other way, and I'd do us no good getting myself hurt. I decided to take a look around the place. I quickly spotted a dinner table. And if I needed proof the police had not bothered with a cleanup, the dinner table was set. The plates were still out. The food rotten to a strange blackened husk. A child's hat lay across one place setting, once a creamy fleece now turned a sickly green yellow. The chairs had their backs reinforced with wooden beams, fitted with long grooves so that something the width of a nail could slide into them. On each of these cushions were foul-smelling stains that looked oddly like an aspirin. I touched one with gloved hands. The material crackled audibly. Similar stains were on the cutlery and plates. There were even handprints of these stains placed firmly on the tablecloth. At first, I thought it was blood, but that wasn't quite right. It was too contained to be from leaking blood. On the back of one of the chairs, a stain tapered exactly where a woman's waist would be, like a near-perfect silhouette. I shivered as I remembered that Miranda Vance had always been a slim woman and wondered how she had left her imprint on the gray fabric. Using my flashlight, I saw that these stains repeated in the oddest of places, some on beds and blankets, even patches on the plain floor, exactly like how you might expect in a room full of sick people. But why did one stain on the floor bear such a strong resemblance to a child huddled in the fetal position? Why was the same stuff all over the TV remote, and on books, on shelves, even board games? Everything from sofa cushions to DVD boxes to piles of dirty laundry were covered in the same dried, brownish material that gave off a foul, coppery miasma. I found the jigsaw particularly baffling. Someone had set up a table with four chairs, all modified with the same back support as the chairs at the dinner table. A jigsaw had been laid out with four separate piles, but only one was depleted. The rest looked largely untouched, almost like someone had portioned out the pieces for three other people who had absolutely no interest in going along with it. Maybe Daniel had tried to keep up the morale while the family were sick? God help me if that were true. I couldn't help but imagine the poor man sat there with his loved ones close to death, desperately trying to encourage them to click their own pieces into place while they faded in and out of consciousness. Something about that room emanated madness. The longer I stayed down, flicking the bright disc of my flashlight from one detail to another, the more I wanted to leave. All the light bulbs had been removed and put in a box on the kitchen countertop. One sofa had been partially disassembled. Multiple beds had been burned, and one door had wooden beams nailed across it. Looking up at the ceiling, I finally had some insight into why the police were so confident that the Vances had not survived, despite never finding their bodies. Someone had jammed a human finger into one of the empty sockets, almost like they expected it to glow with the flick of a switch. What was it about this place that had caused the police to leave and never return? Not to even take that finger and test it for signs of illness, or even just to confirm who it belonged to. I decided it was time to hurry up and find my dog. People had died in this place. And while I'm not superstitious, I can't be the only skeptic who has done the calculations in their head and realized it costs nothing to be respectful of ghosts. The bunker was cramped, terrifying, and the air stank so bad I started to worry I'd get sick myself. It served no one any good to linger. Summoning what little bravery I had left, I called out to Ripley, breaking the silence, something which felt like a terrible taboo in that god-awful place, like screaming in a graveyard. I waited and hoped to hell that I'd hear the pitter-patter of his paws. But for the longest of moments, there was only the kind of silence that makes you wonder if someone or something in the darkness is holding its breath, trying to look like just another patch of nothing, biding its time until you finally turn around and show it your back. Just then, a blurt of white noise so loud and so sudden caused me to cry out, throw my arms up and fall backwards onto a rolled-out sleeping bag that looked like it had spent a week in the sewer. By the time I realized what caused the noise, the TV, I could hear a tinny rendition of Daniel Vance's voice.
Miranda was the first to fall ill. Looking back, it makes perfect sense. Miranda often went into storage.
I frowned at the screen as I approached. It showed a greenish infrared view of the bunker with Daniel up front, the dinner table behind him. Although grainy and hard to see, I could clearly tell that his family were sitting in those chairs.
We found it behind one of the refrigerators. Oh, hell.
Interrupted by a loud clank, Daniel muttered as he got up. One of the figures in the background slumped onto the table, which sent a plate spinning off onto the ground. Daniel grabbed the woman by the shoulders and sat her upright.
Miranda never did like my cooking.
He laughed as he fussed with something at the back of the chair.
All those hours spent taping them upright never worked. These rods, much better. just a little modification, and everyone is able to join in for dinner.
Daniel wandered over to the camera. With a grin, he lifted it from the tripod and scanned the dinner table. What I saw nearly made me drop my flashlight. His family were long dead. Gaunt faces, missing noses, lips that had receded to reveal awful grins. These were corpses plain as day, even when viewed through such a low-resolution image. The only thing that made them seem remotely alive was the way their eyes still reflected the infrared back so that they glowed in the dark. And yet Daniel seemed oblivious to all of it.
I'm working on something similar for family game night.
He tousled Elliot's hair, kissed his wife on the cheek, ran a hand across one young girl's shoulder. He even picked up the young Alexander from his high chair, and I assume he coddled him. I don't know for sure because I looked away, unwilling to see the poor boy up close. Eyes averted from the screen, I couldn't help but pan my flashlight across that same dinner table. I shivered as I finally realized what all those stains were. Not quite blood, but close. Liquefying flesh. Left alone for months, Daniel had not put his family's bodies to rest. Instead, he moved them around from place to place, puppeted them, living life as if nothing really changed. Looking at where those stains had settled, I saw a clear pattern emerge. He put them to bed, he sat them for dinner, he propped them up to watch TV, gave them their favorite books. The idea that horrified me to my core, they sat as lifeless husks as Daniel waited for them to complete a jigsaw.
I made every inch of this place, but I did not install that door in the storage on the bottom level. Elliot didn't believe me. Why would he? It's not part of the original designs. Not on the blueprints. There's no room on the other side. I checked the cameras and some of the photos I took during the build. Wall's just blank. The door is there now? It must lead somewhere. I don't know when or why it opens, but it does. But the next time I'll be ready. I have to know what's on the other side. Why it did this to us. Alone, down here, often all asleep at once. Anything else would have just slit our throats and been done with it. But it didn't. It took its time. It took our radios, computers, phones, one by one. None of us noticing until it was far too late. I kept telling my kids that they needed to take better care of their things. And even as they complained, I just assumed the phones were lying behind some shelf. Where else could they go in a locked bunker? But it wasn't the children at all. Looking back, there's so many signs. Missing lights, drained batteries. How long did we live with it before we finally realized we weren't alone? Was it here every step of the way? A door out of nothing that leads to nowhere, opening onto a blank wall? At least most of the time? There's something behind it. I can hear it shuffling around in there. Wet breathing rattling in its lungs. Horrible sound I hear roaming these halls when it thinks I'm asleep.
I watched and listened to Daniel, fascinated by this strangely compelling rant, when movement caught my eye. I paused the tape and rewound. Squinting, I saw two pinpricks of light in the darkness just over Daniel's shoulder. Slowly, the image resolved itself in my mind. I knew what I was seeing. It turned my blood to ice. Miranda Vance had turned her head. Her lifeless eyes glowed as she fixed them on the back of Daniel's head.
There's not even any point in leaving at this stage. I'm no doctor, but that door is giving off enough radiation to kill a family of seven. Only none of us had touched it. Being in the same room's risky. Should not be lethal, but given how sick we've become, it's pretty obvious our curiosity got the better of us. One by one, we all got too close. Or maybe not. Maybe the thing on the other side came through and did this. I didn't even... Wait. What was that?
Daniel turned and the camera stopped recording. The image it froze on was of a lone man, bright as a star in the camera's lens, facing off against unknowable darkness broken only by six pairs of white, glowing eyes. I became painfully aware of my position relative to this table. I had the painful premonition that if I turned, those chairs would not be empty. I would see the Vances, all of them, Daniel as well, bodies left to rot for years in the dark, heads turned, waiting for me. As this thought passed through my mind, behind me something shifted. It breathed, loud, quick. I knew what it was. I knew. It came at me so fast that when I felt something hot and wet touch my hand, I screamed, only for the presence to suddenly recoil. But then, without hesitation, it leapt at me and bore me to the ground. I wept as Ripley licked my face. He was shivering and, worst of all, silent, which was not normal. He was not a quiet dog. Not when greeting me, and not when excited like he was now. But whatever he'd seen down here, he clung to me. He dug his paws into my shoulders like he wanted to be cradled over them, something he had been too big to do for years. "Oh, you idiot," I cooed in a soft whisper. Even in the dark, I could feel his tail wagging. Joking aside, I felt nothing but relief at finding him. "Let's get the hell out of here." I picked him up, straining a little under the weight but refusing to give in to tired muscles, and I made for the ladder. It wasn't easy climbing the 3 or 4 rungs to the hatch, but I managed it and gave the hatch a shove. First one hand, then two, again and again with everything I had, but still that hatch refused to budge. Pounding at it with my fists, all I achieved was a sore wrist. The hatch had jammed when somehow the handle had been snapped clean off. The metal bar locking it shut was an inch thick. At the very least, I need a pair of pliers or something to cut through it. It was then that I realized that I'd be making a trip to the middle floor. My only consoling thought as I climbed back down, at least it's fixable. There was one door that opened into a concrete stairwell. Standing at the top, I shone my light down the spiraling guardrails, unsure of what it was I hoped to see. There were only harsh shadows and the sense of something foul rising up into the air, a smell that tickled my throat and burned a little in my lungs. I went down quietly, my mind becoming a town hall of its own, questions being shouted with no answers. Had the police even gone down to the middle or the bottom? Had they seen what I'd seen on the TV and just left? Somehow I thought it was unlikely that Daniel's recording had been terrifying enough to send the entire sheriff's department running. Something else had to have done it. The door to nowhere, maybe? At first, I considered leaving Ripley behind, but after losing him the first time, I decided I'd rather risk it just to know that he was right next to me. Besides, he was being quieter than I was, and I didn't feel much like going down those stairs on my own. He accompanied me with only the quiet click-clack of his paws on the concrete, a sound I found deeply comforting as I barely managed to keep my breathing steady and my flashlight from shaking in my hand. Down one floor, I found the workshop exactly as you might expect, a large space filled with generators, fuel and water tanks, boilers and heaters, pretty much anything and everything that you'd need to survive a fallout. Wires, pipes, tubes ran from one end of the room to the other, and even years later, most of the machinery still hummed in the pitch-black emptiness, an idea I found deeply unsettling. I shivered as I looked around the strange tangle of harsh shapes and industrial figures looming out of the walls and floor. Finally, and thankfully, with only one look through, I found a small area Daniel had cordoned off for his own use. About a fifth of the total floor space, there was a large workbench and some seriously high-end machining equipment. Buzzsaws, drills, belt sanders, welding torches, everything a man needed to do it himself. All very well used. Daniel had been busy. I'm not sure exactly what it was he had been working on, but there was an arm on the bench. It sat atop a pile of papers that had slowly turned brown over the years until the whole thing looked like it had been soaked in tobacco spit. On the whiteboard was a faded diagram of what looked like a ball and socket joint. I thought of the tape, of Daniel's little mechanism to keep his family upright. then looked at the arm and suppressed a momentary gag reflex. I don't know if Daniel had been working on posable limbs or just a way to put the decomposing remains back together after they started to fall apart, but the size of the arm suggested a preteen child. And he'd left it out on the surface like it was a disassembled clock. He was also missing a finger. Just how crazy was he? I wondered as I pinched my nose with one hand. I began overturning boxes, looking for a hefty pair of pliers, maybe a hacksaw. Ripley backed away from the noise. Once I made sure he wasn't going anywhere, I carried on, grabbing and pulling a box after box, hoping I'd find what I was looking for, anything to break that metal bar. In the end, I managed to get a pair of bolt cutters, a crowbar, and a heavy-duty pair of pliers. The pliers went into my pocket, the crowbar went down the back of my jeans, and the bolt cutters, too large to be tucked away in my clothes, were clutched in my fists. The bolt cutters felt hefty in my hand, which was a bit of a comfort, but that feeling didn't last long. Out there in the twisted jungle of shadows cast by all those pipes and wires, something moved in the darkness. A figure ran from one machine to the next, thin but its outline unmistakably human. I couldn't help but remember what I'd seen on that tape. Surely it couldn't have been real. Maybe Daniel had rigged something up? Some fishing wire and a motor, maybe? The idea that those bodies had been moving on their own? I couldn't be sure of that, right? Could I? It was a frightening idea. One my mind had latched onto out of sheer panic. Then I saw them. A pair of white pinpricks reflecting back at me from the depths of that cluttered room. Ripley, already behind me, head nuzzled into my leg, pushed even closer against me and let out a barely audible whine under his breath. This was the behavior of a dog who was terrified, close to pissing himself with fear. Just a bit of metal, I told myself, as the light shook so violently in my hand that I struggled to see straight. Just two shiny bits of metal. Then they blinked and began to come towards me. If I had any doubts left, they were dispersed by the sight of a pale white hand emerging into the light. I ran straight to the stairs, but only one or two steps in, I saw something gripping the handrail on the top floor, a moldy clump of flesh barely recognizable as a fist. The flesh withered until the fingers were basically bone. Without meaning to, I brought my light up out of habit. I saw the bloated face of a hairless corpse glaring down at me. I couldn't even tell you if it had been a teenage girl or the six-year-old Daniel. Either way, I instinctively turned and found another body shambling towards me out of the workshop. I was trapped, nowhere to go. By the feel of warm fluid on the back of my leg, I could tell that Ripley had finally pissed himself. God, I needed him to just stay together for a little longer. I couldn't take him in my arms, but I couldn't leave him behind either. With nowhere to go, I ran down and entered the third floor. Storage. Down here, the air was thicker. The sounds of my breathing were muted, somehow distant. There was the temptation to stop once I hit the bottom, but I only had to look back up to see three pairs of eyes glaring down at me. So without giving any of it much further thought, I barreled down the corridor and stumbled onto a door at random. Opening it, I saw what looked like your standard storage room. Only most of the shelves had been overturned, the food left to rot on the floor. The two shelving units that were still upright were covered in tall, opaque boxes. That made them a fantastic hiding spot. I crouched down and turned off my flashlight. The moment my eyes adjusted, I saw the nowhere door. The door almost looked normal. I could see why Daniel must have been confused by it. It looked a little bit like all the other doors down there, but it was too tall and too wide. It was about a foot and a half off the ground. The metal, rusted in its entirety, seemed like it had aged out of sync with everything else down there. All around the jam was a profusion of wet, soppy moss, like the kind you find hanging off trees in a swamp. Every few seconds, the door would leak something strange and oily, like the puddles you find in a parking lot on a rainy day. Of course, that wasn't too strange in itself. The leak was horizontal, defying gravity. Every few seconds, a large glob of the stuff would whip across the room and slap into the wall opposite, creating a puddle about the size of a man that defied all reason. Remembering Daniel's words about radiation, I instinctively inched away from this puddle and the door on the opposite wall. Backing myself into the darkest, quietest corner I could, I pulled Ripley behind me and hoped to hell that he wouldn't give me away. Barely 2 seconds into the hiding spot, a few figures entered the room. Although it was pitch black, they made enough noise to let me know that at least two of them had stumbled in. Unable to see much, I was left unsure if they were heading straight for me or just getting ready to leave. Luck would decide my fate. When I finally heard something scrape against the wall 2 feet from where I stood, I gave up. I switched my light on, desperate to know what was coming for me. No more than 6 inches from my face stood what looked like a living corpse. I would have screamed if not for the flash of intelligence I saw in this being's wide, terrified eyes. It was Daniel Vance. "Get out," he hissed from a toothless and cracked mouth. Before I could comprehend the new information my mind was receiving, I heard a noise, the creaking of a door opening. Without even thinking, I turned my flashlight to the nowhere door. It was open. Behind the strange steel was more than just plain old concrete. Much more. I saw what looked like a raging gullet of flesh, a ringed tube of pulsing muscle, lined with teeth the size of hands, a spiraling descent into madness. Hot, fetid air washed into the room, covering Daniel and I. Paralyzed by what I was seeing, I was unable to take my eyes from the flesh tube beyond the doorway. Daniel whispered as he grabbed me with one fist, "It's coming." He hurled me out of the room. I hit the floor and skidded along a sick fluid, the smell of which turned my stomach. Perhaps the worst detail was that this fluid was cold. It soaked my shirt like I had fallen into a muddy puddle. Then I heard what sounded like a child's whisper say, "It's coming." This voice wasn't Daniel's. Daniel shuffled over to the open door and knelt before it. Although I got the impression that Daniel was aware, I could sense that he had pretty much lost everything else in his mind. He looked back at me once more and spoke before he pressed his head to the floor. "The only thing we did wrong was being here for it to torture. It didn't need a reason, just an opportunity. Leave. It won't let us go. It won't even let us die. And if it catches you, it won't let you go either." His forehead kissed the dirt. He was soon joined by the other figures in the room. As my flashlight hit them, I realized that the entire Vance family was still in the bunker. Not alive, yet not dead. No quicker had I realized this had something reached through the door. It gripped Daniel's head in its palm the way you or I might pick up an apple. The sight of this flushed my mind clean like some kind of enema. In full panic, I grabbed Ripley, grabbed the bolt cutters, and ran like my legs were pistons. Exhaustion and fatigue could not slow me down or cause me to fall. I had to move. I had to leave. I reached the top floor and nearly collapsed from all breathlessness. But I wouldn't let myself stay down for long. That image of Daniel's head being gripped by that unnatural hand replayed in my thoughts. I crawled over to the ladder, climbed up, and immediately went to work trying to cut the metal lock. It was hell with just one hand, the other clinging to the flashlight that I kept frantically pointing at the door behind me. It wasn't long before I fumbled one too many times and dropped my only source of light. "No, no, 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 no," I mewed, but there was no time to look for it. I had to get out, and fast. I could hear something climbing up those stairs, and not the steady thump-thump of human feet. No, this was different. It was a rapid pitter-patter, much like I'd assume a spider running to its caught prey would sound if I was the size of an insect, skittering along the floor, walls, and ceiling. Using all my strength, I leaned hard on the bolt cutters. At last, the bolt gave. I threw the hatch open and just got enough ambient light to see Ripley hovering at the bottom of the ladder, growling ineffectually at the doorway. I crouched down, scooped him up, and fled up the ladder so quickly that my muscles turned to jelly at the top. I fell over onto my hands and knees, but still, I was out. The long entrance corridor, covered in writing, was ahead of me. At the very end, a doorway capped now by the tired blue light of a full moon. Ripley needed no encouragement. He whipped down the corridor with canine speed. I followed at a broken and stumbling crawl, eventually shouldering past the open door and collapsing onto the forest floor. For a few seconds, I drifted in and out of consciousness. But when I looked up and saw the canopy overhead moving, the branches backlit by a full moon, I snapped awake and glared down at something gripping my ankle. The hand had reached out of the dark and seized me. It was slowly dragging me back into the earth below. Whatever it was, most of its body lurked out of sight in the shadows behind the doorway. But the hand that had crushed my leg was the size of my torso, with an arm that looked like it belonged to a mole rat. I struck it with my own fist. I dug my nails in. I cried and kicked and screamed, but nothing could stop it. From behind the door, something like a face grinned and leered at me with joy. It was taking its time, sure enough, pulling me in so slowly that it gave my mind all the time in the world to appreciate the nightmare that awaited me. I think if, in that moment, you'd given me a gun, I would have shot myself. Because God help me, I couldn't escape the look in Daniel's eyes, how he knelt to worship this thing like a man who knew that hope or pride or joy or anything with even a hint of goodness to it was so far out of reach for him that all of it might as well have been a dream. How long was this thing going to keep them down there? How long did it intend to keep me? I wept like a child, feeling my mind was slowly cracking as I tried everything to stop from being pulled into the shadows. I kicked at the earth. I dug into it using my hands, looking for a root or a pipe, anything to hold on to. Nothing. Nothing I did would slow it down either. I was no more than a foot away from the door when Ripley reappeared. A dog afraid of Hoovers and plastic bags and doors that move on their own. A dog who once got stared down by a particularly feisty rabbit who stopped mid-chase and turned around, baffling the predator on its tail. A dog you couldn't even watch scary movies around. He lunged at that arm like he was a wolf, like he'd always been one. And while he didn't quite break the skin, the pressure was enough to make the thing's grip weaken. I slid my leg out. Unable to stand, I knelt, grabbed Ripley, and pulled as hard as I could. As the pressure of Ripley's sliding teeth ripped into this thing's flesh, I saw that it bled. Together, at last, Ripley and I were let go and sent rolling backwards, head over heels. I wasted no time looking or processing. I heaved Ripley to my chest and crawled until I passed out, making it maybe half a kilometer away. Only when I could no longer see the door did I let myself fall to the ground face first and gave up consciousness. The doctor said I had pneumonia, which I suppose made some kind of sense. I might have believed them were it not for the sheriff's visit, asking strange questions of me as I lay in bed about what I may or may not have seen. I dismissed them to the best of my ability. I wasn't interested in chasing that particular nightmare down again, figuring out if it had been real or not. At least not while I lay there half drowning in my own infection. To be fair, I had at least some sympathy for why the police had done so little to seal that place off. I have on occasion thought about going and doing the job myself, but I still have nightmares about being pulled into the dark beyond that door. Not just the bunker door, the one I narrowly avoided at the end, but the one below, the nowhere door. What I saw was a kind of madness, I'm sure of it. And I often think of Daniel's words. He didn't need a reason, just an opportunity. Somehow the Vances were that opportunity. Maybe they built their bunker on a ley line, or a weak spot between dimensions, or the site of former satanic rituals. I'm not even sure it matters. They went into the dark thinking it'd be a safe place to wait out the world's troubles, but something had been down there waiting for them, waiting for a chance to get at a family of seven people, to lock them in and deprive them of escape, to slowly take from them everything it could. I've moved since then. Couldn't help it. It wasn't just the memories, you see. It was the shortwave radio I kept in my basement, something my father passed on to me when I was just a boy. I'd forgotten about it, at least until I woke up one day to the sound of it blaring white noise down in the dark. And buried in that sound was the faint whispering I'd only heard once before. A voice that I only knew as not Daniel's. A whispering voice that kept repeating the same thing.
Let them go. Let them go. Let them go.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.